I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican Senator John McCain is stealing some of rival Barack Obama's thunder today by announcing that 44-year-old Alaska Governor Sarah Palin will be his running mate. A day after Obama brought party faithful to tears in a huge open-air stadium rally in Denver, McCain, who is celebrating his 72nd birthday today, appeared with Palin at a campaign rally in Dayton, Ohio.
She's not from these parts, and she's not from Washington. But when you get to know her, you're going to be as impressed as I am. She's got the grit, integrity, good sense, and fierce devotion to the common good that is exactly what we need in Washington today.
Governor Palin appeared on stage with her family, including four of her five children. Her oldest son, Track, is about to be deployed to Iraq.
It was rightly noted in Denver this week that Hillary left 18 million cracks in the highest, hardest glass ceiling in America. But it turns out the women of America aren't finished yet, and we can shatter that glass ceiling once and for all.
The McCain number two choice may be the headline, but there's still a lot of talk about Obama's acceptance speech in Denver last night. An editorial in today's New York Times says Obama has succeeded in molding his party to his image, but, quote, whether this is all visuals or the start of a new brand of politics is hard to tell. And USA Today writes that Obama helped himself last night, but, quote, he'll need to build his case further. I spoke with Michael Tomasky, editor of the U.S. edition of The Guardian newspaper, and Roger Simon, chief political columnist for The Politico, just moments before Senator McCain appeared with Governor Palin in Ohio. And I asked Roger Simon to tell us a little bit more about Palin.
She is a relatively obscure figure in American national politics. She's in her first term as governor of Alaska. Before that, she was the mayor of a town of, I think, 9,000 people. And while she has some strong Republican conservative credentials, beyond that, I think her choice is really one of the more high-risk choices that we've seen on a national ticket, simply because she is going to spend the next several weeks trying to demonstrate that she is ready from day one to be president of the United States, which is the main job a vice president has.
Right. Maybe high risk, but Michael Tomasky, has she been named to pick up the disgruntled Hillary Clinton supporters?
I'm sure that's part of the motivation behind it. But, you know, we talk about these things politically, and Roger's absolutely right that it's risky politically. But I would, you know, my main reaction is on the merits. And on the merits, I have to say, this is a really deeply irresponsible choice by John McCain. There's no way in the world that Sarah Palin is the most qualified or among the most qualified people he had available to him to be president of the United States. Pundits are going to spend more time talking about Jerry Ferraro for the obvious reasons. But this strikes me as more like Clarence Thomas. Hmm. There's no chance that Clarence Thomas was the most qualified person George H.W. Bush could have named to the Supreme Court. And there's equally no chance that Sarah Palin, who was the governor of a town of 8,000 people just 3 years ago, with absolutely no engagement in her life in national or international politics. This is just a bafflingly irresponsible choice from a governing perspective.
Mm-hmm. But then what would you say is the big reason to choose her? I mean, isn't it because McCain wants to court those women voters?
There are two political reasons. The first, that's the second one. The first one is that he still feels, obviously, that he needs to nail down the base. And right-wingers love this woman. And so I think that's the first thing. And then the second hope is, sure, that independent women will look at her and see an attractive 44-year-old mother and think, hey, you know, she's, look, a woman, and an attractive woman at that. So the Democrats will have their work cut out for them. It's a tricky thing for Democrats politically. You know, on the merits, it's very irresponsible, and I think that's the Democrats' main argument.
Hmm. And, Roger, how would you say she matches up to Obama's running mate, Joe Biden?
Well, I've never heard her speak, so I don't know how she is on the stump. She certainly doesn't measure up to him in terms of resume. She certainly doesn't measure up to him in terms of foreign policy experience, or really experience on a vast number of domestic issues that Joe Biden has spent decades of his life dedicated to. And as to whether this is a sensible political play for the women's vote, especially for disgruntled Hillary Clinton voters, all I'm hearing this morning is disgruntled Hillary Clinton voters saying, you know, this is an insult. We didn't say just any woman would do. That wasn't the point of our backing Hillary Clinton, that we wanted any woman on the ticket. We wanted a woman on the ticket who knew the issues, who was ready from day one to be president, and who had a whole range of experience. So I think the entire play for the women's vote here, besides which there are other Republican women who could have been chosen as John McCain's running mate, who have more experience, and there is a certain factor there that supporters of these women candidates may be insulted. But when you get right down to it, she has Palin has only two jobs: one, to survive this press vetting period that she'll go through for the next 48 or 72 hours, and then really her only job is to debate Joe Biden in the vice presidential debate. After that, you almost never hear about the vice presidential choices. How she is as a debater, I have no idea. I've never heard her debate. Joe Biden showed himself during the Democratic primaries to be pretty good.
Mm. But she is young. I mean, isn't that a factor as well? She's 44 years old. She gave birth, what, to her fifth child not long ago. And that was something that McCain really needed to counter, McCain, who turned 72 today.
She is young. She is 44. He is 72. But while that is a plus, it also raises the question, yeah, he's 72. He's a cancer survivor. And we really have to concentrate on who his choice for vice president is, because that vice president might become president. And on that score, then you really open up a whole bunch of questions about Sarah Palin. Hmm.
And Michael Tomosky, let's go back to Senator Obama's speech last night. You wrote that Obama accomplished something quite subtle for a political speech. What did you mean by that?
Well, my point in what I wrote was that he did manage to make this huge mega event last night, in my opinion, not really about him. Think about all the commentary, much of the commentary leading up to the speech and the decision to move it to the football stadium. It was all said, does it feed into this talk about the Messiah? He's the one, you know, the heavens are going to part and so forth when he takes the stage. And, you know, there was a big concern among supporters that this would be too much a almost a cult of personality glorification of Obama. But I sensed from the crowd and from his text, as I sat there and watched it last night, that he successfully managed to make it not about that. And indeed, I'm watching a little bit of television this morning, flipping back and forth among the cable channels, and nobody is saying that this morning, that this was a big cult of personality event. And Obama even specifically said at one point, what the naysayers have never understood is that this isn't about me, this is about you. But in other language in his speech, he very successfully made it about the Democratic Party and about the country. And so it turned out that that risk of going to the football stadium was something that was very successfully neutralized. And I think to the extent that the speech was successful, and I think it was quite successful, I think that what I'm trying to describe here has a lot to do with that.
Hmm. Let's listen to how Obama addressed two very difficult issues for some politicians.
We may not agree on abortion, but surely we can agree on reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies in this country. The reality of gun ownership may be different for hunters in rural Ohio than they are for those plagued by gang violence in Cleveland, but don't tell me we can't uphold the Second Amendment while keeping AK-47s out of the hands of criminals.
And that's Senator Barack Obama at his acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention last night. Roger Simon, can you tell me what you take from what he said about basically both sides agreeing to disagree?
I thought it was a masterful speech. I thought he answered the question that he was just all about being a celebrity and making inspirational speeches by responding with a very substantive speech that also had a great deal of inspiration. I mean, part of it was drawn from the Hillary Clinton playbook in that he did issue after issue after issue, talking about everything from, you know, bankruptcy reform to the environment. I mean, he did very specific listing of issues. The two clips you just played are also from Bill Clinton's playbook. Abortion, you know, we want to make it safe, legal, and rare, basically. Obama was just doing a restatement of that. And on guns, which is going to be a very troublesome issue for the Democrats, because Joe Biden has very strong pro-gun control backer. Basically, Barack Obama is, again, doing Bill Clinton's theme, which is we're not against hunters. Bill Clinton's formulation was, I've never seen a deer wearing a bulletproof vest. We don't need cop killer bullets. We don't need AK-47s. But the second and I think most masterful part of the speech was Barack Obama directly attacking the Republicans on their main issue in 2004, John McCain's main issue in 2008, which is Republicans are better qualified to fight the war on terror, that they are better qualified to protect the United States. What George Bush did in 2004 was a vote for me or die argument, vote for me or we'll be attacked again. Barack Obama, I think, masterfully addressed that and said this is all baloney. Republicans aren't making you more safe. They're making you less safe. They're fighting the wrong war in Iraq, ignoring the right war in Afghanistan. And time and time and time again, he painted John McCain not as being a committed American with great service to his country, but as not getting it, being out of touch, which was a none too subtle way of Barack Obama saying this guy is old, he's out of it. And we need youth, vigor, and change. And I thought Obama made all those points.
But there were some shortcomings in his speech. He did say that McCain wants to privatize Social Security, for example, which is a bit of a stretch in some parts. And Republicans say that there were parts of the speech that were a bit misleading. What about those charges? Do you think they'll hold any water, Roger?
I don't think most people who watched it last night or are going to see the sound bites from it. What about 46 minutes, I guess, came away concentrating on the Social Security question. I think they came away, first of all, on the image of Barack Obama as an agent of change in a year where 83% of the American people say the country is on the wrong track and want a change. And they also, it was another example, I think Michael touched on it, of this huge enthusiasm gap between the two parties. You know, the line to get into Invesco Field stretched for mile after mile after mile. People waiting in the sun to fill up this stadium with like 84 or 85,000 people. You know, John McCain does not draw crowds like that.
Right.
And it's going to be very hard for the Republicans. And the Republicans are very worried about this gap in passion and enthusiasm between Democrats and Republicans this year.
That's Roger Simon of The Politico and Michael Tomasky of The Guardian newspaper. Just ahead, is New Orleans ready for another hurricane? You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. This was the sound in New Orleans today to mark the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Many of the other ceremonies to mark the day were scaled down as another major storm appears headed toward Louisiana. Tropical Storm Gustav is slowly making its way toward the Gulf Coast after killing dozens of people in Haiti and the Dominican Republic this week. And there have already been evacuations from offshore oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. The National Hurricane Center predicts that Gustav will make landfall along the Gulf Coast as a Category 3 hurricane early next week. John Pope is a reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and he joins us. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Governors in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas have declared states of emergency. There are a couple thousand National Guardsmen who have been activated in Louisiana. What are you seeing right now because of the threat of Gustav?
A lot of uncertainty and anxiety. I think everyone gets up in the morning, logs on, and goes to a couple of weather sites to see what might have happened overnight. And there's just the inherent anxiety about staying here.
Now, in terms of preparedness, though, there have been, what, $2 billion worth of improvements to the levees in New Orleans since Katrina. Does that reassure anyone at all?
Up to a point. You can't test the levees without a disaster.
We read in the Wall Street Journal that federal officials were trying to fortify a stretch of the Industrial Canal, and
yes,
that's the canal that cracked and flooded into the lower Ninth Ward during Katrina. So what's happening with that, and how would you describe the status of the levees?
The promise of getting them up to withstand a Category 5 storm won't come due until 2011. We have seen the levees built up where they were breached. There are floodgates, there are pumps, and things certainly look fortified.
There's also expected evacuation decisions to be made at some point today. What do those plans look like right now?
Well, when it happens, there will be what's called contraflow, where the interstates that would ordinarily go into the city will be reversed just to allow a greater flow out. For those who can't get out under their own steam, there are buses ready and trains and planes.
And it's not evacuated to one large facility like the Superdome, as was done during Katrina.
Forget that one after this crisis at the Superdome. Oh, no.
So where do the evacuees go to?
Right now, we're looking like Atlanta, Memphis, Little Rock. That's by air. Then there are buses to places around the state that aren't threatened.
So what do you think are the big differences when you remember back 3 years ago?
Well, the feds are here, and they are making quite a public show saying that we've got boots on the ground and we are organizing all these plans, which were not around 3 years ago.
What is this day like for you? And Katrina, you were at the office, weren't you?
Oh, yes. The night before the storm, there were a bunch of us up there, and in retrospect, we must have been like the passengers in the first class lounge on the Titanic before it hit the iceberg, because we were visiting, there were snacks, and it was a big reunion. There were people who had worked for us before who were back working for other papers. It was like a big sleepover, and then at 5:30 on Monday morning, the 29th, the power went out, and then the wind came, and the wind was so strong it blew the rain sideways, and some of the big plate glass windows at the front of the building on the third floor in the feature section were bent back into parabolas, and I was at my terminal. The computers kept going, and I was like the mule in Gone with the Wind when Rhett Butler put his coat over his eyes so the mule couldn't see the fire he was going through. I just kept working, and we had an area set up in the photo studio with no windows, with computers, generators, lights, and fans, where a bunch of us kept blogging the entire time. And the wind and rain stopped around 2:30 or 3 Monday afternoon, and we were splashing around in the front yard thinking, okay, it's over, we're going home. But some people who had ridden out in delivery trucks to the eastern parts of the city came back with awful news that folks were standing on their roofs with water up to the eaves. And then two of our guys biked out to Lake Pontchartrain and saw that the 17th Street Canal levee had been breached and water was pouring into the city. And one of the men who lived in that area knew his house was drowning. And they came back and reported, and you could feel these waves of anger and fear just rolling through the newsroom. And then the next morning, I remember waking up about 6:15 and looking out and seeing a lake around our building. And a couple of hours later, we were evacuating in delivery trucks that had water up to the headlights.
The Army Corps of Engineers says Katrina was a rare catastrophic hurricane. Is that any reassurance?
I'd like to believe that. And that's as far as I'm going.
John Pope is reporter for the Times-Picayune. He joined us on the line from New Orleans. John, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, absolutely.
And now this note, as Here and Now heads to St. Paul for the Republican National Convention, these are some sounds from Invesco Field in Denver last night as Barack Obama accepted the Democratic nomination for president.
Imagine 20, 30 years from now saying, yeah, I was there when this was going on.
And here we go. Let's hit it. I can't hear myself.
My wife came, my son and my daughter-in-law came with the two grandbabies. I brought my grandbabies because my grandparents couldn't come. They're the ones who would have enjoyed it.
The same policies, those policies, all over again. Hey, I believe in recycling, but that's ridiculous.
My daughter, she's 7. I had her late in life. But she can look at him and say, I can do it because I have an example that looks like me. It means so much. It means so much.
But I stand before you tonight because all across America, something is stirring. What the naysayers don't understand is that this election has never been about me. It's about you.
And that picture I'm looking at on the screen right now of America's first family represents every creed, hue, and color in the United States of America. I am so proud. I'm so proud.
More than 200 people have been killed in Taliban bombings and clashes in Pakistan since President Pervez Musharraf resigned about 2 weeks ago. The Pakistani government initially tried to address the violence by holding peace talks, but it has since intensified military action against al-Qaeda and Taliban militants in northwestern Pakistan. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones is just back from Pakistan, and he joins us on the line from London. Hello, Owen.
Yes, hello to you.
You've been covering Pakistan for quite a long time. How would you characterize what's happening there right now?
This is as bad as it has ever been. There is a major insurgency going on. It's largely unreported in the West. Oddly, and not, I mean, I don't quite know why, because, I mean, the Pakistani press are doing it day in, day out. You mentioned that figure of 200 dead since Musharraf stepped down. That's right. I mean, you know, if you look at the front pages of the papers in Pakistan each morning, 50 dead, 60 dead, you know, because there's also militants dying. That wouldn't be included in your 200 number. So it is a very intensive conflict. And there are, you know, different insurgencies. It's complicated. And the army now is fighting hard. 120,000 troops in quite a small area. And frankly, they're not doing very well.
Why now, Owen?
I think it's just built up, really. I mean, there was this political element to it with these ceasefire talks after the elections and so on. So there's a sort of political timetable going on inside Pakistan. But basically, this has been building for 2 or 3 years, and we've got to the point now where the militants are confident, they think it's going well, they're winning territory, they're rattling the army, they're getting soldiers to desert, so they feel on the up, and they're fighting hard, they think they can win.
When you were there, you spoke with one of the government leaders. You asked former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif whether the Taliban should be banned. Let's listen to a clip of what he said.
We should all get together. Don't ask for any verdict from me now or a decision. Let the parliament, which is an elected body, a sovereign parliament, take the judgment and a decision on the subject.
That was Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Owen Bennett-Jones, why not be more forceful than just let parliament decide this?
I thought it was extraordinary, really, because, I mean, he is a very senior figure. You know, I mean, subsequently they have been banned. I put the same question, it's quite odd this, I'll just tell you this, that I put the same question to Asif Zardari, the man who's going to be president, a couple of days after speaking to Nawaz Sharif, and said, look, you know, these people are killing, you know, just the day before they'd killed 70 people, and they're not on your list of banned organisations. You know, other groups are. Why not? And funnily enough, the next day they banned them. So I don't know if there's any connection at all, but it was slightly odd. But Nawaz Sharif just said, you know, he just didn't want to take the decision. And that is partly because he is still trying to do what Pakistani leaders have done forever, which is to make accommodations with the extreme religious right, because they do have, you know, 10% or so of the people. That means they do have parliamentary support. They can be useful. And he is still trying to sort of run with the hare and chase to the hounds, or however the expression goes. And, you know, it does seem odd. And the Americans don't like it at all, obviously. So he is paying a price for it in terms of American support. But that is his line.
Let's talk about Zardari for a minute. He, of course, is the widower of assassinated former Pakistan Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Where is he now? And he's expected to take office next week, isn't that right?
Yep, he looks like he's going to win. He says he's got the numbers. And so, you know, he is now in a situation where he's trying to please America, being very tough on the Taliban doing this ban, saying that, you know, he's going to fight the fight and so on. And that's where he stands. Now, many people in Pakistan are pretty shocked that he is taking over. I mean, he is a man with a reputation. He has faced many, many corruption charges in the past, but he's insisted on his innocence. And all those cases have now gone away. I mean, General Musharraf basically did an amnesty. It was called a National Reconciliation Order, which was quite specific to a small group of people, one of whom was Asif Zardari. And then the Swiss had a case against him in which they had actually convicted him and his wife of money laundering. But that has been appealed and now dropped. So as I understand it, there are actually no cases whatsoever. It must be the first time in 20, 30 years. There are no cases against him whatsoever.
And let's go back to the militant fighting and what's happening there. There's also obviously a refugee situation. Some folks are saying it's a major humanitarian crisis on the border with Afghanistan. What can you tell us about what's happening there?
Well, it's something like 200,000 people. I mean, it's a huge movement. I mean, because what's going on is you've got the Pakistan Taliban fighting in South Waziristan, one of the tribal areas. Then in North Waziristan, you've got Al-Qaeda. And then in Bajor, you've got a sort of tribal insurgency going on. And then in Kurram, you've got a sectarian thing going on. And Khyber, a sort of criminal. So all these tribal areas have got these different conflicts happening. And some of them are extremely bloody and involving the army doing helicopter gunship assaults and artillery bombings and that sort of thing. So people are, you know, obviously having to leave. And they're turning up outside near Peshawar in big numbers, you know, with cross and desperate. And so the Pakistan state, as ever, it's weak, it's disorganized, it's not really coping, it's trying to send a few supplies up and so on, but not really managing with the scale of it. I mean, happily, a lot of these people have relatives who are living near Peshawar, so they can go and stay with them. And I think many of the 200,000 will be doing that. But, you know, there is some families are really up against it at the moment.
You know, it sounds as if everything is unraveling.
It's really bad. I mean, they've got this big fight on now. And, you know, I was just reading today, there's a big battle going on a road near Peshawar. The whole road closed down, you know, and this is a major road. So I don't think Western governments have quite got it yet that they do really. I mean, they've been saying for so long to the Pakistan government, you've got to fight harder, you've got to fight harder. I think actually they are fighting hard now because the Pakistanis have come to realise too that they really have a big problem. And there are these emirates being declared, you know. The Swat Valley's just been declared an emirate. Now, Pakistan is now fighting in these places and I think may prevail. I mean, the army, you know, they do have problems with desertions and so on, but they are still a disciplined and highly, you know, organised outfit. And I think they may prevail, certainly in the settled areas, if not in the tribal areas. And we may be that in 2 or 3 months it looks slightly better. But right now, it's rough going.
Are people saying at all the ruling coalition should be better able to deal with this? You wanted Musharraf out, you got him out, and now this is happening. Is there a backlash?
I mean, you know, the American and British officials were going over there insisting on democratization. And, of course, you know, there are many people who support that. But you know, what they've got are politicians who are not terribly democratic. I mean, Asif Zardari hasn't been elected by anyone yet. And he may be that he wins this election for the presidency. He probably will. But, you know, they're not the political parties are not very democratic outfits. They have leaders for life and they're dominated by families. And, you know, the whole idea of this transfer to democracy is slightly flawed in that it's not really democracy. So, you know, and it's so unaccountable in so many ways that it's slightly naive, I think, for these officials to go in there and say, look, it'd be much better to have democracy, you should do this, you should do that, and be quite intrusive into internal Pakistani affairs. But that's what's happened, and they've ended up with this government, which, you know, we'll just have to see whether it's got the commitment to fight.
We've got just about a minute here, Owen. Let's just say President Musharraf was obviously a strong U.S. ally. What are the stakes for the U.S. here?
Well, the stakes are huge for all of us. I mean, this is now, you know, if you think that Al-Qaeda has suffered serious reverses in Iraq, which it has, and in Saudi Arabia, which it has, it is having this major success in the border areas of Pakistan. It's fighting, it thinks it's winning, and the United States is desperate. It's put in $20 billion into this struggle. It is desperate for more results, and it's not yet getting them.
Owen Bennett-Jones of the BBC, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, here-now.org, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. It's Here and Now. back to presidential politics in the United States. As we said, the Republicans are heading to St. Paul for next week's convention, and so is Here and Now. Before she left for Minneapolis, Here and Now's Robin Young left us two postcards from the Mile High City. Here's the first from Wheat Ridge, Colorado, just outside Denver.
Independent truckers are hit hard at the pumps here at the Travel America truck stop in Wheat Ridge. The price of gas rises faster than what they're paid to do a job. But employed truckers are suffering as well. They're often paid a percentage of the worth of a load, and after the price of fuel, that load is worth a lot less. That's what drivers like Anthony told us. He was at the pumps, his wife up in the cab. He's watching the conventions closely.
Yes, I am. I'm a homeowner, taxpayer, and I'm tired of people telling me something they're going to do and they don't do it. Basically, they're talking about, I like to hear the education part. If you got no education, you got nothing.
What?
You're never going to find a politician to tell you the truth.
You think not?
No, not. Look at the world that we're living in now. The first thing should have been on everybody's agenda is the school education. These kids are supposed to be our future. Have you seen where half of these kids are at now? In jail.
You know the driver?
Yeah.
You must be listening to a lot of radio. So what aren't you hearing from the candidates?
Actually, I have books on CD that I listen to a lot of.
Okay, well, when you do listen in, what aren't you hearing from the candidates?
Gas prices going down, the economy getting straightened out.
How much does it take for you to fill your truck?
Half a tank. It'll cost about $989.
Oh, my gosh.
I've been up to $750.
And you're at $223 now. That's the strangest thing to see on it.
It's only 51 gallons. No one cares about truckers as long as the stuff gets cross-country. That's all they worry about. And there will never, ever be another truck strike. If we actually go on strike, we can get put in jail. And then when the mileage goes down, how does the roads get fixed? Where do they get their money if not off per gallon fuel? And if people ain't going to travel and people aren't going to use fuel, how are we going to fix our roads? These trucks are made as light as they can, and they're falling apart going down the roads. It's almost all plastic in these trucks now. And you go down the road, that's everything you hear is rattles or cracks in the trucks.
As we left Travel America, I climbed up on the running board of a huge rig just arrived from Texas, my microphone barely reaching the driver way up in the cab. And there we found one of Barack Obama's biggest challenges.
Hi. What are you not hearing from the candidates?
The truth? Just not hearing the truth. When Hillary lost out, everything went to hell.
Truly, you were for Hillary Clinton?
Yes. I don't know why she lost out. I'm not prejudiced, and I think that's what we need in Washington to straighten the mess up. As a woman.
Can she persuade you to vote for Barack Obama?
No. Don't get me started on Barack Obama, because I'll be arrested.
Why?
I believe in the Bible, and I don't believe he's a true American.
Yeah, and you don't think he's a Christian?
No.
Why don't you? If he went to church for 30 years and claims to have, found Christ?
I don't know. I find that very hard to believe. There's pictures of him where he doesn't stand up and salute the American flag and he wants to lead our country. I don't think so. I'll vote, but I'm probably going to close my eyes and make a mark.
Okay, well, listen, thank you and have a safe drive.
All right, thanks, ma'am.
It's Robin Young at the Travel America truck stop in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. In a minute, she'll cross the street to get the view from the Catch-22 karaoke bar. By the way, next week on Here and Now, we look back at the legacy of George W. Bush. He'll address Republican delegates on Labor Day. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. While the Democrats were politicking and nominating and partying in Denver, it was business as usual at the Catch-22 Lounge in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Here again is Here and Now's Robin Young with this audio postcard.
There's Mr. G.
Tell me his name. I want to know.
Jenny.
It's you. So brand new.
Michael.
Baby loves me, yes, yes she does. All the girls out of sight, yeah.
They're regulars at Rich Phillips' It's Your Tune Karaoke at the Catch-22 Lounge in the basement of the Howard Johnson's, where we stayed here in Wheat Ridge.
I've got singers that come 40 miles east of Brighton, which it takes them right at an hour to get here.
Are there some big dreams maybe up on that stage when you...
Oh, well, they say no, but, you know, sometimes I think there is, especially Chris. I mean, he's got some dreams, but he's young enough to do it.
A little bit of back porch, a little bit of swing, a little bit of wind chimes, I'm going ding-a-ling.
It's never been a dream until about 5 years ago. I was in Oklahoma, and these cowboys threw me up on stage and told me to sing, and I was all shy, and I did it, and, well, y'all heard me.
What's your day job?
I'm a pipe fitter. I travel all over America, which I'm getting really tired of.
Many of the singers seem to be living the songs they're singing. Mike is recovering from a devastating motorcycle accident and head injury. And it used to be Rich and Bonnie's karaoke, but Bonnie had a devastating back injury. With your wife being sick, is health care an issue for you?
Well, yeah, it really is, because her medical is just outrageous. Her insurance company pays around $3,000 a month just on her medication. And, of course, I have to pick up the rest of it myself every month, and it makes it's a hardship, really. All I have is my Social Security and this little part-time job here, and it seems like the insurance just keeps going up in price. You know, they can only raise it, I think it's once a year, but they just did that this month.
Are you looking for a presidential candidate who you think might be able to fix that? Or
not really. Everybody claims they could do it, but it never happens.
That's a common theme here at the Catch-22, a world of hurt, but no sense of political empowerment. We sat down with Sage, who sings and plays the harmonica.
I've been lied to.
One of the major issues for me is health insurance. You know, I think everybody has a right to health insurance.
Do you not have any?
No. Who can afford it? And also, the homeless, you know, because I was homeless for 3 years. Not because I was an alcoholic or a drug addict or anything like that. It was unforeseen circumstances out of my control. You know, they have shelters and all, but they put them out on the street during the day. And there's a lot of broken people that they don't know how to get their life together because they're broken, you know, and they need help with that.
Is anyone saying anything that encourages you, that gives you some hope on that?
Well, they might say things, you know, but...
Well, the Democrats have been pushing for universal health care for everybody.
Yeah, and I really hope that goes through. My son died of cancer, leukemia, in 1999. He was 20 years old. He got sick with a cold, and they found out he had a lot of white blood cells. And he just got the bare necessity care because I didn't have money. I mean, his treatments costed like four.
She's not from these parts, and she's not from Washington.
Boy, I am so sorry. You know, these songs, you know, must offer some relief. You're nodding.
Yeah, and I play blues harp because I've lived the blues and I feel it.
She looked like he was the last man on earth. Gave him everything she ever had.
Jennifer Bader, fantastic.
Thanks.
Did you ever think of singing professionally?
Yeah. But, you know, I've got little men, and it's kind of hard to have a career like that, trying to raise a child, so.
We should say you've got the little man in your lap, Logan.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, the song that you were singing about broken dreams, I just wondered if that resonated for you.
Well, yeah, because I've danced and sang my whole life. Since I was 3, I was in dance class. I did point, tap. When I got older, you know, it's harder to work and be able to afford stuff like that, like dance classes and stuff. And then I had him, and he became my priority right away. And then after that, you know, you kind of just give up on your own stuff. But not too mad. I think I have really high expectations of life, which makes it easier for me to live. Somebody told me once, if you shoot for the moon and you don't make it, at least you're up there with the stars. So that's kind of how I feel.
How old is Logan?
3. And I want him to have everything that I didn't have, so.
You know, we're covering the convention.
Right.
Have you been paying much attention?
No, not really, actually. I kind of work a lot.
You work more than one job, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I bartend at another bar up in Golden. Well, I watched it a little bit today, and I don't know. I still wish Hillary Clinton was running for president, so, yeah. Hey, stop messing with that.
Oops, Logan has turned on the jukebox. It's time for him to go home anyway. Well, now we're outside Catch-22. So you're not paying as close attention to this convention, but what would you like to hear?
Honestly, to think about the middle-class people. That's really, that's it. There's more of us, you know, and we struggle more, I think, than anybody else because we don't get the government help, you know, because we do work real hard for what we have, and more jobs, I think, is what we need. Lots and lots more jobs, especially here. I like when John McCain talks about the exploration of, what do they call it?
Offshore oil?
Yeah, the drilling. And I know there's risks, but if they can do it safely, that would create tons of jobs for Americans.
The analysts say that there's not that much oil there, you know.
They don't know that, you know. They don't know unless they're drilling.
But, you know, it's funny. When we go from the convention with all the hoopla, back to our motel rooms, it feels like a different world.
Oh, I bet. I can only imagine what it's like to be there with everybody, you know, like, all excited. And sometimes when I'm watching TV and I'm like, I see them get real riled up about certain views and stuff, I'm like, oh, yeah, I can totally feel it. But since Hillary can't be president, I'd prefer John McCain. He's got our class in mind.
Stop. You're such a nut. Jennifer, thanks so much for talking to us. And I hope you get to do your dancing and, you know, all the stuff you want to do. I hope you get to do that.
Yeah, me too. That'll be nice. Go open a dance studio or something.
Good night, Logan.
Good night.
With a broken wing, she carries her dreams. Man, you
Robin Young at the Catch 22 Lounge in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. And goodbye and many thanks to intern Hamad Ahmed. Best of luck in New York. We know we'll be hearing you on the radio very soon. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again next week from St. Paul, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.